It is Thursday, June 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a Taliban car bombing kills and wounds scores of people in Afghanistan.
This is the third time that in this city, Lashkar Gah, this bank has been targeted by the Taliban.
A Canadian-Tunisian man is charged with attacking a police officer at a Michigan airport, and women are playing a larger role in Hollywood, both behind and in front of the cameras. It's all ahead. A massive suicide car bomb blast in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province Thursday killed at least 34 people and wounded more than 60 others. Witnesses said soldiers and government employees had gathered outside a bank in the provincial capital of Lashkar Gah to collect their salaries when the bomber struck them. The deadly bombing came ahead of Sunday's Eid festival, which marks the end of the holy Islamic fasting month of Ramadan. I spoke with Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan, who's reporting on the attack. I asked him about the significance of the location of the explosion.
Well, usually the new Kabul bank is where the members of the Afghan security forces are paid their salaries, monthly salaries. And this is the third time that in this city, Lashkar Gah, this bank has been targeted by the Taliban. And today, once again, was a day when members of Afghan security forces and other government employees had gathered in front of the bank in large numbers to collect their salaries when this suicide bomber struck them and exploded this car packed with so much explosives that it has caused a lot of casualties. As of this moment, what we know officially is that at least 30 people have died and more than 60 wounded, although independent sources tell us that the death toll is much higher.
Now, the Taliban has claimed responsibility. Did it say why it carried out this attack?
Well, the Taliban in their statement, they once again said that since they are fighting the security forces and their international allies, that's why they targeted these people who had gathered outside this bank. And they are claiming that there were no civilians present at the time of the attack that they carried out, because according to the Taliban claim, the today and that particular time of the day was reserved for Afghan security forces to come to the bank and collect their salaries. And the Taliban spokesman claims that the death toll, according to their claim, is more than 80, which is quite a huge death toll, but it is very difficult to independently verify as of this moment whether they are telling the truth.
Well, now, the security situation in Afghanistan has been declining in recent months. What are the reasons for this?
Well, obviously, the primary reason is that Afghan security forces, although the United States has spent billions of dollars to train this security force, but what we have seen is that there has been widespread corruption, especially at the leadership level among the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces. And these commanders who are fighting the Taliban in the battlefield either take bribes from the Taliban, according to some reports, and quietly vacate the areas, or they just do not encourage their security forces to be on the offensive. So this is what is helping the Taliban to keep attacking Afghan security forces and keep capturing more and more territory. So that is the one reason. Corruption has been the primary reason, according to SIGAR, which is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. That has prevented Afghan security forces from effectively tackling the resurgent Taliban.
Well, now, meanwhile, the Afghan Election Commission has announced today that long-delayed parliamentary and district council elections will be held in July of next year. Could that impact the security situation at all in Afghanistan?
Well, while making this announcement, the Independent Election Commission chief today acknowledged that security situation has worsened across the country, but still they have been able to put together preparations for these elections. But immediately after they announced the date, once again, we saw a lot of criticism of the government, because the security, the reforms in the electoral process that have been long demanded have not yet taken place. So this date of election next year is quite unrealistic in a way that President Ashraf Ghani is already under pressure to resign because his security policies have not been able to provide security to Afghans. And even within the Afghan government, there is opposition now to his rule. And opposition parties and politicians are also demonstrating on the streets calling for his resignation. So whether the current national unity government headed by President Ghani survives by that time is a big question. So it's like more than 13 months that they want to hold the elections, but President Ghani is already under a lot of pressure to really sort of encourage an inclusive government. And this is what the United Nations Special Representative to Afghanistan in his briefing to the Security Council on Wednesday in New York underscored, that the government needs to include all its coalition partners to introduce reforms and to conduct governance, because the criticism of Ghani has been that he's sort of individually, even though it's a coalition government, but he's not paying attention to the demands and needs of his partners, governing partners like Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah. So with all this political tension plaguing the government, any election, whether it will be possible for the government to survive by that time is another question. And this political uncertainty in the government is also helping the insurgents in the countryside to really influence the local population to convince them and to try to tell them that their rulers are corrupt and are incompetent. So that is why they are even receiving support from the population in parts of the country. So there is a serious question about the political stability before any elections are held in the country.
Ayaz Gul reporting from Islamabad, Pakistan. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Oh, it is a very busy day here in Washington, D.C. But then again, aren't they all busy in one form or another? But three big stories today going on. First one just breaking within the past few moments, President Trump declaring that he does not have any tapes of his conversation with former FBI Director James Comey. As you remember, he tweeted out and said, wait until the tapes come out.
Yeah.
Comey had said he hoped that there were tapes that would reveal what they had talked about. Well, Trump sending out a series of tweets saying, with all of the recently reported electronic surveillance, intercepts, unmasking, and illegal leaking of information, I have no idea whether there are tapes or recordings of my conversations with James Comey, but I did not make and do not have any such recordings. So some clarification on that point from President Trump. As we said, this is just breaking, so we'll be looking into the reaction on social media as that develops. But also lots of reaction today on the hashtag healthcare bill. The Senate Republicans have released their version of the bill to repeal and replace Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, as it's otherwise known. Lots of video coming out of a number of elderly and disabled protesters in front of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office being kind of dragged away. That video spreading around social media as those people protest this bill, saying they're going to lose coverage. Others saying that there's not enough time to read this bill before the quick vote that they want to try to get in before the Senate recesses for the summer. But others saying that many people didn't read the Obamacare bill or the Affordable Care Act bill before that was voted on and passed. They said, why would this be any different? So a little bit of political gamesmanship back and forth there. And then finally, hashtag restore the vote. The rally on Capitol Hill going on today as legislators try to reintroduce the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965 to try to cut down on some of the voter discrimination during the Civil Rights era. In the 2013, the Supreme Court struck it down, saying that the country had changed and we did not need a federal law to preserve voting rights. Well, there have been a number of instances, these politicians note, of voting rights abuses in the past few years. So now they're reintroducing this bill and using hashtag restore the vote to do so. And with actually both of these stories, this hashtag healthcare bill and hashtag restore the vote, we're seeing members of Congress actually using social media to lobby their constituents, either trying to drum up support for these bills or try to explain why they're not right and why they shouldn't pass. But social media has been a very powerful tool. I've seen a number of senators and members of the House of Representatives tweeting out where they stand on this bill, encouraging their constituents to contact them via social media so that they can have a conversation. But that's the new way that we communicate, I guess, in this day and age with our elected representatives. We can do it through 140 characters or less.
Yeah, we can avoid their secretaries as well.
Yes.
Okay, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The new executive order by President Donald Trump may increase U.S. visa wait times. As we heard, the U.S. Senate unveils a health care bill. Funeral is held for Otto Warmbier. And President Trump questions why the Obama administration didn't thwart Russian election meddling. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Egyptologists from the University of Basel in Switzerland and other experts have re-examined what just might be the oldest prosthetic device in human history. The scientists say they determined that an artificial wooden toe is almost 3,000 years old and that it had to be refitted several times over the lifetime of its owner, who was identified as the daughter of an Egyptian priest. Using modern microscopy, X-ray technology, and computer tomography, the scientists theorized the prosthetic device had to be crafted by an artisan who was very familiar with the physical characteristics of the human big toe sometime around 1000 BC. The artificial toe was found to be meticulously crafted and offered its owner functionality, a natural look, and wearing comfort. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at the growing cloud of women in Hollywood. U.S. and Canadian law enforcement officials are investigating Wednesday's stabbing of a Michigan police officer at Bishop International Airport in Flint by a Canadian Muslim suspect. Special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, David Gellio, said the incident is being treated as an act of terrorism.
We have just filed a complaint charging an individual by the name of Amor Fatoui. He's a 50-year-old resident of Canada who legally entered the United States in Lake Champlain, New York on June 16th. And made his way to Flint. And since it is a pending investigation, I'm not going to go into great detail as to what we do know, but we do know Mr. Fatoui entered the airport. He spent a little time on the first level, then he went upstairs, he spent some time in the restaurant up there, and then he came out, he was carrying baggage. He went into a restroom, he spent a little time in the restroom, dropped both bags and came out, pulled out a knife, yelled Allah Akbar and stabbed Lieutenant Neville in the neck.
After the attack, 16-year police veteran Jeff Neville's condition was upgraded to satisfactory. Investigators say Fatoui from Montreal appeared to have acted alone. He was also heard to reference killings in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. They said during questioning, Fatoui expressed his hatred of the United States. Canadian media reported police searched his home and made a number of arrests. With some exceptions, Canadians entering the U.S. do not need a visa. University of Toronto political science professor Nelson Wiseman tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, however, Wednesday's attack may heighten concern about the relative ease with which Canadians can travel to the United States.
This incident reminds me of an incident which could have been much, much more serious that occurred 17 years ago, the case of the Millennium Bomber. And this was a man, Ahmed Rassam, who also lived in Montreal, who was also from North Africa, because I believe the current suspect is from Tunisia. That gentleman, Rassam, was from Algeria, and he was in Canada illegally. He claimed refugee status. He turned to pickpocketing at airports and elsewhere. He was convicted. He was ordered deported, but he didn't leave. He adopted a false name, and he, with others, filled up a trunk with explosives. He did cross into the United States, taking the Port Angeles ferry from Victoria, B.C. to Port Angeles, Washington. And by chance, he was asked to open the trunk. He panicked. He ran. He was caught. And he was heading to the Los Angeles airport to bomb it on New Year's Eve to the year 2000.
We've had a spate of terrorist attacks, similar attacks in Paris and other places in Europe, and we find out that police have certain people on a security watch list. Is that how Canadian authorities are handling these kinds of things?
Yes, authorities in all Western states are doing this. The problem, however, is you can have people on watch lists, but we are a society of laws and civil liberties. Not only can you not arrest people without cause, but you can't monitor them 24 hours a day.
Does Montreal have a substantial Muslim population?
It does. Toronto's is larger, but they tend to come more from Pakistan, Bangladesh, India. We do have a number of Arabs. Montreal has many more Arab Muslims, and that's related to the language laws. One of the requirements for coming into Canada is if you can exhibit facility in one of the two official languages, English or French. Many North Africans, because of the French colonial legacy in North Africa, have facility in French. And in this case, the gentleman that was involved in the attack today, who is from, apparently, Tunisia.
Fatoui has been charged with violence at an international airport, which is a federal crime. He's being held without bail and could face up to 20 years in prison if convicted. A hearing is scheduled for next week. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Women have always been an essential component of Hollywood as lead actresses in the romance genre in comedy and drama. But women have found it difficult to establish themselves in roles traditionally claimed by men in the film industry, such as filmmakers and leads of superhero films. This summer, that ceiling has finally been broken by talented women. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
$500 million and counting. That's right, you heard it right. Wonder Woman, starring mesmerizing actress Gal Gadot and filmmaker Patty Jenkins, have broken the box office record for a female director.
I care about making the greatest Wonder Woman of all time because I love Wonder Woman and I'm a filmmaker. So that nothing's ever going to make that more interesting to me. So the fact that I'm a woman or she's a woman or we're all women or whatever was a wonderful deep part of it. But it also you just tune it out completely because I'm just a filmmaker trying to make a film that I care about that much anyway.
Jenkins's Wonder Woman is the best depiction of Princess Diana of Themyscira so far, because it combines impressive high-action sequences with a great story arc about Wonder Woman's journey, leaving her utopian world to go to the war front during World War II to fight and defeat evil. Jenkins's superheroine model combines power and grace.
Being a hero is often not a proactive state of being of going and punching somebody out and therefore things being over. It ends up being so much more on an everyday scale about understanding and love and forgiveness and the complexity of life.
Next to this great woman is brave pilot Steve Trevor, interpreted by Chris Pine.
I am so lucky that Patty was the one to direct me. Her vision for Diana was in line with mine.
The dynamic duo of Gal Gadot and Patty Jenkins is more proof that Hollywood studios can entrust big-budget productions to women. And they are not the only ones. Filmmaker Sofia Coppola recently received the coveted Palme d'Or for Best Director at Cannes Film Festival for her remake period drama, The Beguiled.
Amy! Help! What happened?
The original movie is from the male point of view, the soldier's point of view of this woman's world. And I thought it would be so interesting to go back and find the book and tell the same premise, but from the women characters' point of view.
The film offers poetic cinematography and an all-star female cast. Nicole Kidman and Kirsten Dunst play the lead roles as teachers in charge of an upper-class boarding school for women fending for themselves during the United States Civil War. Their orderly life is disrupted by a handsome, injured Union soldier seeking refuge at the school, sowing discord and jealousy among the women. Sofia Coppola is only the second woman to win Best Director at Cannes in 71 years, and though many would argue she has an advantage in the industry coming from the Coppola filmmaking dynasty, her talent is undeniable.
Still only 4% of women directed, I think, the major motion pictures of 2016.
Wonder Woman's box office triumph and The Beguiled's artistic recognition are opening the door for more female auteurs in mainstream Hollywood. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Oh, what have you done to me?
And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Pan American Development Foundation, known as PADF, celebrated the success of dozens of Haitian entrepreneurs supported by the LEAD program at a large exposition at the Caribe Hotel in Port-au-Prince earlier this month. Through the LEAD program, which stands for Leveraging Effective Application of Direct Investments, USAID has provided 45 Haitian and diaspora-led entrepreneurs with the capital and technical support needed to grow their business. Implemented by the PADF, the program supports long-term economic growth in the region. Each company was awarded a grant after successfully completing a business plan competition. Together, these enterprises have created more than 13,600 jobs in Haiti and are on track to create a total of 18,000 jobs by the end of the year. Since 2011, USAID's LEAD program has invested $7.4 million in businesses in various sectors of the Haitian economy, unlocking $12.7 million in private capital. LEAD has also delivered more than 10,000 hours of training to entrepreneurs to build their capacity and improve business operations. Together, LEAD-supported businesses, from the sanitary paper production plant to the solid waste processing plant, have generated nearly $28 million in sales. It's inspiring to be in a room with so many dynamic and creative Haitian entrepreneurs, said Nadia Cherouk, PADF country director. Their businesses are a testament to what can be achieved through hard work and persistence. Through LEAD, we are helping Haitians realize their business goals and creating a network of innovators. These entrepreneurs are paving the way to a more prosperous Haiti. The event included a business-to-business networking session to help the entrepreneurs forge important relationships with financial institutions, service providers, and sector experts. USAID's LEAD project aims to attract investments in Haiti's small and medium-sized enterprises and increase the development impact or remittances. We congratulate the entrepreneurs here today, said Brian Choucan, chargé d'affaires of the U.S. Embassy in Haiti. You are leaders of Haiti's new economy. The LEAD project's investment in these innovative entrepreneurs has unlocked millions in private capital. As their businesses grow, we anticipate that they will continue to attract financing from banks and equity investors, driving further economic development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.